Welcome to the Power Play Podcast, where international cricketer Kyron Powell and marketing genius Jordan Shannon join forces, bringing you captivating conversations with the biggest players in cricket and business. Join us as we dive into the lives of current stars in the cricketing world, the legends before them, and those extraordinary icons whose performances changed the game in both cricket and business. Exploring journeys both on and off the pitch, the boardroom, and everything in between. Get ready for an exhilarating blend of cricket, life, and business insights with two insatiably passionate, infuriatingly no-holds-barred hosts, who, unfortunately for the rest of us, live and breathe this stuff for a living.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us today, which is going to be episode 29 of the Power Play Podcast. I'm Jordan Shannon, your host, and as always, I'm with my co-host, Kyron Powell. But today, we have a very special guest in Fazeer Mohammed. Thank you so much for joining us today, Fazeer, and welcome to the Power Play Podcast.
Good to be on the show. Good to be on the program.
No, it's our pleasure. In terms of obviously starting out the chat today, where did your sort of interest in cricket sort of come from?
Well, basically, I was sort of born into the game, really, because my dad was a very active cricketer, a very passionate cricketer, maybe sometimes too passionate, but that's how it is when you love the game. So I more or less grew up in the environment of club cricket here in Trinidad and Tobago. Trinidad is my home island. And essentially, not just watching the game being played at club level, because, of course, you're talking about the late 1960s, early 1970s. There was nothing like the blanket television coverage that you have now. So you would basically be following newspaper reports. You'd be watching club cricket in your nearby community. Yeah. But also, I think what helped me in my fascination with the game is that my father's fanaticism extended to buying every available publication, the West Indies Cricket Annual, edited by Tony Kozier, the late legendary Tony Kozier, had just come out for the first time in 1970. So you had that. And basically every cricket book that was available at the time, he would buy it. So when other kids would probably be learning their reading through the typical first year, second year textbooks, I would be reading a lot of cricket material. George Headley, a comic book about Frank Worrell, and other publications, autobiographies of Fred Truman, for example. And that more or less sort of introduced me to the international scope of cricket. So it was basically being in an environment of cricket and also reading and learning a lot about cricket, even though it wasn't anything like the coverage that we had now.
Yeah, fair enough. In terms of the cricket, at what point did you start playing? Or did you start playing?
I actually started playing at primary school, but I wasn't very good at that level. I wasn't very good at any level, really. But then went into the secondary school environment. And the reason I actually developed as a left-arm orthodox spinner was because my dad was naturally left-handed. Right. I'm naturally right-handed. But he coached me left-handed. So you had this sort of bizarre situation where I would bowl left-handed, bat left-handed, but I would chase after the ball and throw it in right-handed. And that would confuse everybody. But again, that's how it was. I played the game at secondary school level at St. Mary's College, played through the age groups, got to be able to represent the school at first 11, actually made it into the Trinidad and Tobago under 19 team for one tour in 1983 to Jamaica. I only played one match. I was very fortunate. We played against Jamaica. I got 9 wickets in the match, 6 in the first innings, 3 in the second. But that was the last match of the tournament for us because we didn't qualify for the final. Come the next year, when you'd think I'd be an automatic selection, there were better left-arm spinners. So I'm one of the few that I can recall who actually played one year, did well enough, and couldn't make the team the second year. So that was it for me as far as hopes of national representation, because I played club cricket for Queen's Park, the top club, the home where Queen's Park Oval is, of course. But I was never good enough to get on to the highest levels of the game. And I think pretty early on, I realized that if I ever was going to associate myself with the game at the highest level, journalism, getting involved in the media, that was going to be my avenue in that regard.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. So did you always, I know you mentioned there, obviously from, you was obviously had interest in reading about cricket and learning about the game and that side of things. So at what point did it trigger to go, you know what, I'm going to go down that avenue?
A-levels, because it was an absolute disaster. I did economics, accounts, and history at A-levels. And because I'm in a family business, in fact, I'm in the business office right now.
Yeah,
we've been around for 54 years as an electrical supplies business here in Trinidad.
Fantastic.
It was thought of as something automatic that I'd get into the account side of things and take charge of it that way. But as I said, it was absolutely abysmal, the exam results of 1983. My excuse is that it was around the same time the West Indies lost the World Cup final to India in 1983. But it's a convenient excuse, but I was going to fail anyway. In fact, I'm one of the few people I know, apart from the fact that making the under-19 team 1 year and couldn't make it the next year, I have O-level passes at A-levels. It was so bad that I was graded not A, B, C, D, E, but I was given an O for one of my subjects. So it is what it is. And then I realized, well, look, I'm never going to be the accountant I aspired to be, which is probably a good thing, because the fact is that we're still in business suggests that they kept me far away from the books. But I realized that the only skill, only sort of ability I had was in writing. And I actually spent a year in Canada sort of redoing the equivalent of A-levels. And that isolation, being away from everybody, being away from different influences saying, you got to do this, you got to do that, it sort of cleared my head to realize, look, the only skill I have is an expression, in this case, writing. And rather than go on to university in Canada, I came back home to Trinidad and applied for a job in the daily newspapers, the Trinidad Express and the Trinidad Guardian. Right. And the Guardian gave me an opportunity as a freelancer in 1986. Right. And that was really my first foot in the door in the media.
Right, okay. So how old was you been in 86, if you don't mind me asking?
21.
Right, okay. Yeah. So from there, that's obviously where that side of the cricketing aspect, or was that just journalism as a whole?
It was journalism right across the board. Initially, I wanted a job in the sports department, but there was nothing available. So I did freelance work, actually covering secondary school's football. Football was really my beat for a few months. And then when a permanent position opened up, it was actually in the newsroom. So I was covering everything. Parliament, the courts, which was dead boring. I used to fall asleep following those sessions. But, you know, covering different events and just so more or less whatever you would do as a junior reporter in any newsroom. And then eventually I transferred to the sub-editor's desk, which is when you were editing the copy of other writers. So that was useful as well, because it gave me an understanding of what was required and editing and so on. And then I actually moved into the sports department. So that's where I really settled down for a while. Not just cricket, but covering more sports and getting familiar with that environment for a couple of years.
Fantastic. So from there, then, where did that opportunity come from to get into the cricketing world?
Well, the opportunity actually arose when I left the environment of The Guardian. I was working there, doing cricket, covering cricket, covering football, covering every sport available. But when you talk about actually specializing as a broadcaster, commentator in cricket, that came about in 1992, when I actually moved from The Guardian newspaper to what was then known as Radio Trinidad. And that's when I got the opportunity for a regional match. I sort of harassed and harangued the editor, saying, look, you know, I don't have the playing experience, but I love the game. I think I know a bit about the game, and I'm happy for an opportunity like a ball-by-ball commentator so that you can test out my knowledge and my understanding of the game. It was for a match, Trinidad and Tobago versus Barbados at Queen's Park Oval. And it's, again, it's one of those oddities that I was asked to be an expert comments person. I said, well, expert in what? I've never played the game at the highest level. But as it turned out, I didn't do a bad job, because when you really think about it, apart from the in my day and what I used to do in my day, if you know the game and understand the game and you watch the game live, you can actually give some insights, some useful insights.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. As it turned out, on the last day of that four-day match, one of our outstanding and veteran commentators, Joseph Reds Pereira, he had to fly off to another island. Reds is always going everywhere when it comes to cricket. He's always somewhere when it comes to cricket. And that gave me the opportunity on the last day of that match to actually do ball-by-ball commentary. And again, I didn't do badly, so I got the opportunity. Then, because of that and that exposure, I did the historic visit of South Africa to the Caribbean. I did ball-by-ball commentary in 1992 for those one-day internationals in Trinidad. In those days, there would be a different commentary team for every different island, because broadcasters would be based in those islands. There was nothing like what we have now with overall rights and traveling commentary teams and anything like that. So my exposure would have been radio commentary in Trinidad for those couple of years, 1992, 93, 94, 95. I would do commentary for when the visiting teams, Pakistan in 1993, England in 1994, Australia in 1995, that historic watershed series where the West Indies lost at home for the first time in 23 years, lost a series for the first time in 15 years anywhere in the world. So that was really my grounding when it came to radio commentary, because it was all exclusively radio. There was not a dream of ever getting involved in television commentary.
Once you got started on the commentary side of things, and you mentioned there some of the series that you covered, who was a real influence to you, and who really sort of helped you during that sort of introductory period into it?
I would say Tony Cozier, no question about it. I think Tony, because he was such an icon, someone who did everything as far as broadcast journalism, radio, television, the written stuff, writing for newspapers all over the world. He was someone, and I still regard, the greatest all-round cricket broadcaster, journalist, bar none. I mean, you have your Arlotts, you have your Benos, and so on, but I'm talking about someone who excelled in every different aspect of cricket coverage, whether the written form, the broadcast form, radio, television, and so on. And I basically not so much mimicked him, because I don't think that does yourself any justice to mimic somebody, but follow his style and appreciate what he did. And when there were visiting commentators, for example, when South Africa came, Gerald de Kock, he was the visiting commentator. 1993, when Pakistan came, Kamar Ahmed, who's based in London, he was there. 1994, you had Jonathan Agnew and so many others from the UK who were there for England. 1995, Jim Maxwell, who I spoke to quite a bit about understanding what broadcasting is about, understanding that, yes, you want to paint a picture, but never forget that when it comes to radio, you always give the score. You always remind your audience of the score.
Yeah.
Never forget the fundamentals. And I think one thing Jim told me that has really stuck with me, and it's because I committed one of the cardinal sins. I can't remember what day it was, but the game was petering out into a draw. And I said, well, look, you know, it's pretty boring. It's not going to be all that exciting today. And Jim quietly pulled me aside after my commentary stint to remind me that we are in the privileged position, whether it's boring or not, of being able to describe something we love when people stuck in a dead-end job or someone doing something that they really don't like but are listening to the cricket. The last thing they want to hear is somebody telling them how boring it is.
Yeah.
So I realize that it's actually my job to make it interesting, to find things to talk about the history, talk about context, talk about different elements of maybe of the ground, Queen's Park Oval, Gwarakara Park, with the oil refinery not too far away, and so many different things. So it was all an education, that period of time, and recognizing that you have a responsibility to your audience and essentially to avoid getting swell-headed.
No, I think that the way you talked about that, it's a massive skill, in my opinion, the way that commentators describe, passages of play, or even, such a, simple delivery it might be. And I think it might have been a podcast I was actually listening to, and I think it was regarding Tony Kozy talking about how he, as a bowler runs in, he's describing the bowler, and then all of a sudden it then switches and it's about the batter, and it's describing how he plays it. I've always found it really quite therapeutic listening to cricket commentary, on the radio, and the way that they describe it, it has this real way of allowing you to vision what's going on and things. And I think it's a real, real skill. In terms of, I just wanted to quickly ask you before we start talking about the West Indies in a bit more detail, is what would your biggest piece of advice be for somebody looking to get into commentary, and what is it they would need from a skill set perspective?
If we're talking radio commentary,
yeah, obviously, from a radio perspective.
It has to be the vocabulary.
Right.
You can love the game, yes, and of course that's almost a given, but it has to be that you should develop your skills, a lot of reading, and basically, in my case, following the styles of others to a certain extent, and watching how they do it, listening to others, listening to the way they describe the game, but develop your own style. More than anything else, you've got to know the game, as with anything else, any other profession. Because I think you're quickly sorted out by the audience when you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And when it comes to painting that picture, that's where the vocabulary comes in. I mean, we may not all have the gifts of an Arlott or a Blofeld or an Alan McGilvery and so on, but that doesn't preclude us being able to describe different things. You might see someone walking in a Caribbean environment with a basket over their head, selling fruits and vegetables or whatever, different scenes, different settings. You look at the names around the stands and you paint a picture.
Yeah.
I think one of the most touching sort of compliments I was ever given was actually in St. Vincent, when I was taking a taxi from the airport to the hotel for the match the next day. And the taxi driver was telling me that his mom was blind and she really appreciated my ability to describe the game.
Wow.
And I felt, so that to me is actually what it's all about. Because when it comes to radio, you are the eyes of the audience. You don't want to overdo it and get carried away, because more than anything else, they want to know what's the score. Yeah. What's happening? How many overs? That sort of thing. But it really is about not getting so egotistical that you think everything is about what you say, but understanding that there are people always tuning in. You might have just given the score 2 minutes ago, but someone might have just turned on and they've only got a couple of minutes in their lunch break or whatever, and you quickly recap the score, even as you're describing so many other things. So I think it's a combination of skills, but more than anything, it's knowledge of the game and really having a good vocabulary that allows you to express yourself.
Yeah. So looking obviously now in terms of West Indies, when you obviously started doing it in 92 and onwards, what do you believe was the reason why the West Indies were so successful during that period of time?
I think it was a culture of excellence. It was, we often talk about that period, the 70s, 80s, of course, the 80s was utter dominance, the 90s when it started to fade away. But the West Indies were the kings of the game in the 1960s with Sobers and Canai and Hall and Griffith. In the 1950s, winning a test series in England for the first time. You basically grew up in an environment where, when you talked about West Indies cricket, it was considered nothing less than the best was good enough. I remember playing my first club match for Queen's Park in 1982 at the age of 17, and a gentleman by the name of Charlie Davis was the captain. Now, Charlie Davis played just 15 test matches for the West Indies, didn't win a single one, but he averaged over 50. That was from 1968 to 1973, and he left the game because he couldn't feed his family. There was really no money in the game at the time. But the reason I mentioned Charlie Davis is that when on that first day for the Queen's Park Cricket Club, I saw Charlie's West Indies cap, and I almost just stood back in awe. I didn't even want to touch it because someone said, "You know, why don't you try it on?" And I felt it would have been a desecration if I would even touch the West Indies cap, because I wasn't a West Indies player.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's the era that I grew up in.
Yeah.
That sense of awe, that look, there goes Viv Richards, there's Clive Lloyd, there's Alvin Kalicharan. And I was never someone in pursuit of autographs. I don't have a single autograph of anybody. In fact, the only autograph I have is of Mark Taylor, the Australian captain, because my sister harangued me to get it from him on my first tour of Australia in 96-97. But you just stood back in awe of these individuals. And when you saw them in the local environment, in the club environment, in the national environment, you just associated an incredible level of skill and success with them. And I think that permeated our club structure, even our school structure, because our school structure, the cricket played was 2 days where you started at 10 in the morning, finished at 6 in the evening. There was nothing like 50 overs or T20 or anything like that.
No.
And you played it with an intensity as if you were playing a test match.
Yeah. And what do you think then caused I don't want to say the demise, because that's, I think that's a bit too of a heavy description, but what sort of like caused the decline then as such for the West Indies dominance?
Well, I have no qualms about any sort of description, because I actually described it as a plummet from the summit. It wasn't so much a slide. We went off a cliff, because if anyone takes the time to look at the results test match wise, post 1996, in fact, starting with the West Indies tour of Pakistan in 1997, the West Indies went a period of losing 18 of 20 test matches away from home. So it wasn't as if it was just a gradual decline.
Yeah.
It was just a plummet for reasons that are many faceted. But if I were to really put a finger on it, because people always talk about facilities, infrastructure, and those sorts of things, player discipline, mercenaries, all that sort of thing. I think we were just complacent. We felt that this would continue forever. And yes, the facilities weren't the greatest, but even when they weren't the greatest, we had world-class teams. Yeah. We had world-beating teams. People talk about, well, you know, there was a sort of a deliberate attempt to keep us out of England and county cricket. The fact of the matter is that when we were in county cricket, we had our low period from 69 to 73, but we dominated when we were in county cricket. We dominated after the county cricket. Yeah. So that's just part of it. I think the governance issue in West Indies cricket remains a fundamental concern. We just had a summit of leaders in the Caribbean right here in Trinidad just over a month ago. And that issue of governance came up again, because what is happening in West Indies cricket is that the politics has taken over way too much. We've always had politics. People talk about, well, you know, in my day, we didn't have this, we didn't have that. Rubbish. We had insularity. I remember in 1981, and we're talking about the start of the 1980s, the most dominant period that the West Indies enjoyed in the game, where Derek Murray's career had come to an end. And fans of Trinidad and Tobago cricket, they sabotaged the pitch at Queen's Park Oval and delayed the start of a test match in protest action because Derek Murray was no longer in the team. So insularity has always been there, always will be there, because we are all different territories. As anyone can tell you, when you say the Olympic Games, it's Jamaica, Usain Bolt and company, it's Barbados, it's Trinidad and Tobago, it's Guyana. When it's World Cup football, it's individual territories again. When it's cricket, it's the West Indies. So that insularity will always be there. It is there now. I don't think it's any better or any worse. It just is what it is. I think that we more or less took it for granted that we would always have world-class players like a conveyor belt, and we didn't put in the governance structure to meet the requirements of the modern era. And up to now, we haven't put in that governance structure. It's still very, very political. And I think because of that, our cricket has suffered, not just at the West Indies level, but at the different national levels, it suffered really badly.
Sorry, Jordan, let me just jump in here because I have a question to follow up on that based on Faz's answer. Faz, in terms of, I guess, the insularity, nepotism, all these things that have been prevalent in West Indies cricket throughout the years, this summit, I find, was a very interesting one because, to me, that will take us further away from parity than closer to parity because there's already enough issues as it is with the cricketing nations. You can look at it. Every time there's an election, whatever territory becomes elected, you see heavy representation from that territory. But now when you start adding in politicians and the egos of Caribbean politicians, as well as each individual country, as you said, thinking that, okay, based on our history, we've produced X amount of players, or we invest X amount of money into West Indies cricket. How does that help in any way, shape, or form to sort of bring any parity? Because without some sort of level playing ground, West Indies cricket will unfortunately continue to slide where, I mean, you said we fell off a cliff, but we've been falling. We're not hit rock bottom yet. So how far is rock bottom after 30 years?
Well, I would say, Kyron, in not necessarily defending West Indies cricket, but there are some encouraging signs. I mean, the Test match victory in Australia, we can't get away from that. Winning a Test match in Australia for the first time in 27 years. But you're right. When we talk about Test cricket in particular, there's a lot to be concerned about because the game at school level throughout the Caribbean, it's hardly being played as it used to be played. So that's a concern. T20 level, we have the T20 World Cup just a matter of days away. We have West Indies playing South Africa as I'm talking to you right now, getting ready for that series. So in the shorter formats, certainly T20, we're thereabouts as far as being competitive. 50 overs, well, we know the disgrace last year of not even qualifying for a World Cup. I mean, who would have thought that? West Indies not even being able to qualify for a World Cup. So as to that summit, I don't see that as solving anything because for two reasons. One, you alluded to the politics and the politicians. Second reason is that we've done all this before. We've had five different professional studies on the construct of West Indies cricket. And they've all come back saying the same thing. Governance model. It is too politicized, but no one wants to change it because the people who are to change it are the ones who are in control, who actually votes themselves out of existence. It takes a level of vision and maturity to do that, Kyron. And I think it's really wishful thinking to think that they will do that. Secondly, when it comes to the politicians of the Caribbean, they are no different. And therefore, it's a dangerous road to go down if you have politicians that directly influencing West Indies cricket. You don't want to be like Pakistan, where when they change governments, they change cricket boards. That's how it goes. Sri Lanka, same thing, which again makes a mockery of what the ICC says about no political interference, because that is trademark political interference, and the ICC does nothing about it. So basically, excuse me, what we have a situation where it requires us as Caribbean people to look beyond ourselves and say it's not about how many people from Trinidad, how many people from Nevis, how many people from Barbados or wherever, but choosing the right people for the job, the professionals to do the job. Because what we have now in Cricket West Indies is the professionals who are hired, do their studies, come up with their recommendations, and then it's shut down by a board that is preoccupied with politics and only make decisions based on political consideration. So it's a very different and difficult balancing act. But to answer your specific question, I really have no optimism based on that summit that was held a couple of weeks ago?
It's a sad state of affairs because, as I said, I don't think that we've ever lacked the talent in the Caribbean. You know, we've always had natural talent. You look at under 19 World Cups, for example, you're always going to find talent coming through. And the thing is, like, I don't know if the board or the respective boards think that you need an entire team to come through from an under 19 World Cup. You don't. An under 19 World Cup is every 2 years. You're going to have people in the senior team. And if you can get one or two from each under 19 World Cup, it filters into West Indies team over time. I think that's sufficient. But I think what we need to look at is, for mine in particular, the amount of cricket not being played in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Because you look at the franchise setup, for example, I think that it's an extremely flawed model. We have over 330 days of sunshine in the Caribbean and play less cricket than England that has 7 to 8 months of rain per year. That doesn't make any sense. How can you be paying people in a country where weather is not an issue to play cricket, but they're playing, let's say, 3 months worth of cricket per year when you add in 40 and Super 50 combined because CPL is an entity unto itself and there's no Caribbean T20 to identify local talent, again, which is another flaw in my opinion. But I think that there needs to be a lot more cricket played in the Caribbean because obviously players aren't getting the opportunities to go overseas. So you need to find a way for us to hone our skills domestically.
And I think the question in relation to that is, where's the money going to come from to pay for that? Because it's not like as it used to be many, many years ago, Kyron. Long before you were born, it was almost automatic, whether in Nevis or Trinidad or Guyana or anywhere else, where because there weren't as many opportunities as there are now in doing many other things, and that would be financially rewarding, there was enough of a pool of talent playing the game. And so almost automatically, you'd have so many good cricketers from different territories competing for a few places, so the cream would automatically rise to the top. Mm. Now you have a situation where schools will tell you, look, we don't have the budget for a cricket program. Who's going to pay for a cricket coach? Not me, because I can barely make ends meet coping with the security considerations, for example, in a place like Trinidad, where we have so much crime and violence affecting young people especially. The priority is the safety and security of young people. We'd love for them to go out and play cricket, play football, netball, tennis, do everything you want. But in a time of limited resources, scarce resources as it would be for much of the Caribbean, you have to prioritize based on a nation's priorities. It's very selfish to say, well, you know, we should put all this money into cricket when you have health considerations and other considerations. But if we were to get sponsors on board and sponsors speak to credibility, we have a situation right now in Trinidad and Tobago where all of the sponsors have exited the doors of the Trinidad and Tobago Cricket Board because of $500,000 that has gone missing. And to make it even more ludicrous, the individual who highlighted it and reported it to the police has been kicked out of the cricket board for basically blowing the whistle. So, I mean, I know it's a discussion in the UK as well about the dangers of being a whistleblower. It's happened in Australia just within the last week. Someone has gone to jail for highlighting what went on with Australian soldiers in Afghanistan. So, I mean, we could go off in many different directions, but to your specific point, where's the money going to come from to finance the growth of the game at the grassroots level once again?
I think funds are never really an issue in this world. I think West Indies are positioned geographically in an amazing position where you have the US not too far up. You look at all these sports hedge funds investing in various leagues, etc. I don't think it's going to be something where governments go alone. I think it's going to be sort of a CARICOM effort, a joint effort with West Indies cricket, where they go and you might have to privatize West Indies cricket and sell off a stake of West Indies cricket to sort of fund the regrowth. I can't say the growth of West Indies cricket, but the regrowth of West Indies cricket. And it doesn't have to be 50% of West Indies cricket, whatever valuation you put on West Indies cricket. But I just think that the marketing of West Indies cricket is poorly executed. When you look at the history that we have, we're pretty much everyone around the world's second favorite team apart from their home country. When you travel the world, everyone tells you about the history of the Viv Richards, the Joel Garners, the Gary Sobers, etc. But yet still no one can buy a Viv Richards jersey, which will still be a hot-selling topic. I mean, you look at this World Cup, for example, but is it a situation where they don't want to do a revenue split with the people involved? Who knows? But I don't think that with the amount of money going around in sports leagues at the moment and people investing into and buying various sports leagues around the world, that we can necessarily use the excuse that where the funds are going to come from. I think we need to hire the necessary people that are equipped enough and have done it before in various leagues and entities and get them on board to do a feasibility study on how we're going to position West Indies cricket and privatize the game to some extent to bring in some sort of funds to grow West Indies cricket again.
It's a good point. Again, I suppose when you think about it, who's going to hire these right, correct people? Because again, it comes back to the administrators. Because if we're talking about putting the right people in the right positions, if you've got a governance structure that is flawed, where you've got square pegs and round holes, and who don't want to give up that position, can they be trusted to make the right decisions for the long term welfare, not just the short and medium term? West Indies cricket as a test match entity, yeah, God willing, is going to be 100 years old in 2028. 100 years of test match cricket. Are people even thinking about that as something that you can latch on to as a relaunching point for West Indies cricket, for example? You know, so there are many opportunities, but it really requires, one, that vision, and two, that selflessness to realize that it's not about me, it's not about you, it's not about any one of us, but it's about something that's an entity that you said is the equivalent of Brazilian football. It's everybody else's second favorite.
Yeah, that's such a good comparison. Definitely. It is.
I'll let you jump back in, Jordan. You look like you're itching with a question.
You know, highlight and get back on board with this commercially and utilising people's experiences from a cricketing perspective, but also from a business side of things to maximise the opportunity. And as you mentioned there, Fazer, as well, about obviously the approaching 100 years playing test cricket, you know, there's going to be should be maximising and trying to utilise the opportunity to really drive that home. I just quickly wanted to ask, and Philo Wallace mentioned this last week, if West Indies are going to be really successful in this T20 World Cup, and say, for instance, they were going to go and win that, do you think off the back of that, they could use that as a springboard commercially to really sort of drive some revenue into the Caribbean and really try and use that as a, you know, to really kick on and push on?
Of course they could, but again, do they have the people in place now to do it? Because if you go by the evidence of 2012 and 2016, when we won the World T20, nothing happened. So again, there's a real disconnect, and people often ask that question. They say, you know, you see all these players, you see your Nicholas Puran, your Kieran Pollard, your Dwayne Bravo, Sunil Narine, Chris Gayle, and so many others, and Rovman Powell, and so many others now.
Yeah.
You say, there's so much talent available, but you guys just don't seem to be able to get it together, whether in T20 or any other format. And again, it comes back to governance. It comes back to understanding your role. And basically, let's say, for example, if there was a serious effort to build towards this World T20 and the West Indies were to win, it should be a springboard to get sponsors on board, to get proper deals, proper arrangements. But all of that will only take off if there's transparency and accountability.
Yeah.
We had a CPL contract signed in 2013 for 50 years. And again, you know, many people say, well, you know, what does it matter? Because CPL will be taking all the losses because the CPL has yet to turn a profit after all this time. But the point is, if you have an environment where it's considered normal to be secretive about things you do, then who's going to want to buy into that?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to want to say, well, you know, I'm going to put my millions into West Indies cricket and not ask a question as to where the money is going? Or what is it being used for? Or what is it being channeled towards? You've got to have credibility, real credibility, as an administration if you want to be able to attract those hedge funds or whatever you want to call it, anything, any sort of international financing, is not going to just turn up on your door simply because you've won a world title.
Yeah. So, looking ahead to the World Cup, I know we've been talking there, obviously, off field. How do you feel on field they could go about? You know, could they get to the semi final and go on, you know, and potentially then go on to win it?
I think the way it's structured, should be able to advance to the Super Eights, because when you're talking about their group, for example. Afghanistan, New Zealand, obviously the major challenges, New Zealand especially, but Afghanistan on their day can beat anyone, so you don't take them for granted. And then you've got Papua New Guinea, Uganda. The West Indies should be able to move into the Super 8s phase. Getting to the semifinals, it's going to be tough, because I think West Indies have the wherewithal, they have the quality. Whether they can put it together, whether they can actually perform when it's required and perform at the optimum level, I think that is where the challenge is going to be. Because we've seen it too often where the individual players are good enough, but the sum of the parts doesn't actually deliver. And I think that is the concern, because it's felt that the bowling is a bit weak compared to the batting, and therefore... We have to see how things turn out, but it's going to be tough, because you're talking about a world title. You're talking about teams that are going to be at their best, teams that have a culture of winning, like Australia, for example. England had a poor defense of the 50 over title, but you could expect them to come on strong. New Zealand can never be overlooked. You've got India there with the weight of a nation on their shoulders. There are a lot of heavyweight contenders for this world T20.
Yeah, I think, you know, from my perspective, and me and Karen have discussed it the past few weeks, that is, you know, you have got some of the personnel to go out there and beat any team on its day, and hopefully some of the conditions will favour the West Indies, and you know, and there's also a little bit of the unknown that we've discussed as well in terms of how the wickets will play in America, but hopefully, you know, off the back of some of the lads doing quite well in the IPL as well, and obviously can try and kick on a little bit as well on that side of things.
Well, I think I know for sure before Faz comes back in that the guys coming from the IPL are going to find it a stark difference coming to the Caribbean conditions, because there's not going to be any 260 plays, 250 happening in the Caribbean. I mean, those are 50 over type scores in the Caribbean. The pitches and the nature of our surfaces just don't allow for players to play like that. So I think in that sense, it should, I guess, favour West Indies. I mean, they're used to the conditions a lot more than others, and I think that they'll probably choose to chase based on them knowing what Faz rightfully said, is that their bowling won't be necessarily their strength. I'd see West Indies as far as getting to the Super 8s. For me, if they could get to the semifinals, I think that would be a huge thing for West Indies cricket. We're not even talking about the finals. If they could get to the semifinals, I think that would be a great representation, given where West Indies cricket is right now. And as far as I said, coming off of that test win in Australia and heading into a test series in England, I think 8 days after the T20 World Cup final as well, it'd be like a good position, a good launching pad for West Indies cricket to sort of try and move forward in a positive direction and build upon.
I just wanted to ask you, in terms of the test series, who coming over to the UK, who do you see sort of being the sort of shining light for West Indies at the minute coming over?
Well, I think there's obviously a lot of excitement in the aftermath of that Brisbane test match victory about Shamar Joseph. I mean, that's inevitable. I mean, you're talking about someone with his background from native Guyana and all the challenges that he would have faced to get a fifer on his first day of Test cricket, to get Steve Smith with the first ball he bowls in Test cricket, and then pick up 7 wickets with that badly bruised toe in Brisbane to lead the West Indies to a first Test match victory in Australia since 1997. He's obviously going to be the focus.
Yeah,
what it's up to the other West Indies players to do is to help take that focus and obviously that pressure off him. by also performing as well. And I think the West Indies have a better than decent fast bowling attack. Not just Shamar Joseph, you've got Alzari Joseph, you've got Jaden Seals, if he's fully fit. You've got Kemar Roach, who is very experienced, but generally struggles away from home, especially over the last couple of years, but he's got vast experience. He's playing with Surrey in the, in the English County Championship and got quite a bit of experience there. You've got Jason Holder in support. He's playing in England as well with Worcestershire, so he's getting exposure. So you've got their players who can deliver for the West Indies with the ball. The batting looks vulnerable. Again, in English conditions, that is going to be a concern. But I think what we saw in Australia that was heartening was the fight, the willingness to fight. But that will only take you so far. You've got to be able to recognize that, certainly for batters like Alec Athanase, for example, Kavem Hodge, and these players who are getting opportunities at the highest level of the game in the toughest format of the game, that is really going to be a test for them to cope with the moving ball, even if it's bright sunshine, to cope with the English conditions, starting at Lord's, second test in Nottingham, then in Birmingham. So it is going to be a real challenge. The good thing is that the West Indies' last two visits to the UK, it was 1-1 going to the final test.
Yeah.
That in itself is an encouraging sign, because previously the West Indies would have been beaten comfortably in test match series in England prior to the year 2000. So now you have a situation between 2000 and 2017 where the West Indies were beaten badly every time. And now with the last two series, you're seeing a greater level of competitiveness. And it's up to these players to take it that one step further, to show that they could sustain the effort over three test matches against England in England. So it's going to be a real challenge for the West Indies.
And I think to build up on that first, obviously the English bowling attack is not, I mean, you're missing Stuart Broad and obviously Jimmy Anderson after the first test. So it's not going to be the most formidable bowling attack that they would have had to face in years gone by as well. So that's going to give them, I guess, somewhat respite and reprieve from, I guess, the sustained pressure that those two bring with the experience. So they definitely stand a chance. But as you said, it's important that they start well, especially the young batters coming over here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because playing in English conditions, I mean, those who talk about it, they tell you, and Karen, you would have had your own experience as well, against the moving ball. And in a strange way, the absence of Anderson and Broad could actually work to England's benefit, because you're giving hungry young fast bowlers an opportunity who've been waiting in the wings for forever, waiting for Anderson's career to come to an end, waiting for Broad's career to come to an end. And I'm sure they're going to be bursting out of the stables at Lord's to prove themselves. So it's a proving ground in many ways. So I don't think the West Indies can afford to say, well, okay, Broad and Anderson aren't there anymore, we could take it a bit easier, although I respect your point. The fact is that their careers had to come to an end at some time, and therefore they're going to have to cope with the younger breed of fast bowlers coming out of the UK and desperately wanting to be successful, to be available for the next tour and the next. Because as we all know, when it comes to English cricket, they live and die for the Ashes.
Yeah.
Everything is about pre-Ashes or post-Ashes.
Yeah.
So there's that tremendous level of competitiveness in that regard.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that the West Indies can take confidence in the fact that there is no Anderson and Broad. But ultimately, like you mentioned there, there's obviously going to be, well, I think they'll probably play close to maybe six or seven seamers throughout the series, probably potentially close to maybe even eight, to sort of to see which works, which partnerships work. And like you mentioned there, we do over here live and die by the Ashes. That's just what goes by. So they'll be looking at this raw pace. They'll be looking at, you know, more to do with that raw pace rather than the sort of sideways movement that we might get over here. So I do think there'll be plenty of chopping and changes throughout it. But that, in my opinion as well, will be an advantage to the West Indies, because they will be looking at how it works down under and things. So I think they've got a great opportunity to take to sort of, I don't want to sound like I'm being detrimental here, but I do think that they've got a great opportunity rather than sort of coming over and struggling. I think that I think they'll do well.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are so many different angles to it, because it always feels a bit disrespected when you hear about England. For example, and Karen might recall this, when England came to the Caribbean in 2019, Stuart Broad didn't play the first test match. They came in 2022 without Broad and Anderson.
They came here without both, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, so it felt as if, well, it's only the West Indies and it doesn't really matter. Yet England lost both series.
Yeah.
England have only won one test series in the Caribbean in the last 50 years, 2004. So there seems to be a level of disregard. And I don't know if the West Indies players themselves don't use that as a motivation to say, look, you know, maybe we may be lightly regarded, but please don't discount the history and the facts about West Indies cricket versus England, certainly in the Caribbean. But also, this might be the opportunity to get one up on England if they're going to be, as you say, going with as many as 8 different pacers across 3 tests. That might be the opportunity for the West Indies to capitalize and say, okay, you take us as batting practice or bowling practice for the Ashes, we'll take home the trophy.
That's the way I see it anyway. I think they'll chop and change, and off the back of the World Cup and then going straight into the series as well, it's whether, you know, it's what will take place there and how we'll get people into the side and things. I wanted to ask you a few things in terms of going back to the going side of things, if you didn't mind. And sure. You know, some of the test matches that you've done sort of work on and things, what are your most sort of special moments that you remember and most iconic to you?
Well, one that comes automatically to mind is Brian Lara's 153 not out in Barbados against Australia. I had the good fortune to be on commentary towards the end. And all my memorable moments are actually radio commentary. I've done a bit of television, my first love is radio. It doesn't pay nearly as well as television, which is why all of the big names go towards television. When it comes to memorable moments, that sticks out automatically because of the, you know, getting caught up in it and trying to stay professional and describe it and describe the moment. Another one that comes to mind almost automatically is my first stint of ball-by-ball radio commentary outside of the Caribbean, which was in Pakistan in 1997. And actually, it only happened by accident, because the two Caribbean commentators who were selected initially, Reds Pereira, who I mentioned earlier, and Hugh Crosskill, who was unwell, they had to be pulled out and replaced by myself and my Barbadian colleague, Andrew Mason. So it was a situation where we were in Peshawar in Pakistan, and I was listening to the broadcaster in Barbados saying, we now join our commentator Fazir Mohammed in Pakistan. And I almost couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that maybe 3 days ago, I had no inkling whatsoever of getting this opportunity. And there I was on a chilly morning in Peshawar in November of 1997, about to describe the game to a Caribbean audience at 1 o'clock in the morning back home in the Caribbean. So that comes to mind automatically. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go on.
The final one that comes to mind is my first actual tour, which was in Australia in 1996, 97. I didn't do any broadcasting because I was a non-entity. So I had no gravitas to get into any commentary position. I was just doing writing. But actually going to the WACA, which is a pretty nondescript ground. There isn't really anything that stands out when you think about the WACA in Perth. But the reason it was sort of a pilgrimage for me is because my first real fascination with international cricket was in 1975, when one Roy Fredericks scored 169, his 100 coming off 71 balls or something like that. And the West Indies scored 585 in a day and a half. People talk about baz ball and all that sort of thing. But the West Indies won by an innings in Perth. And when I saw the highlights, black and white television, 6 weeks after the fact, there was this fascination with Australia in general, but the Waka in particular. So actually going there and being there in 1996 was sort of like a cricketing pilgrimage completed, basically.
Wow. Fantastic. A real insight into some iconic moments. And thank you so much. And obviously, I'd just like to thank you, you know, for joining us tonight. I really appreciate you taking out your time to come on to the Power Play podcast. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. I'm happy to be a part of it. And let's look forward to some good cricket, exciting cricket over the next few weeks and months.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks, Phil.
Cheers, Kai.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Power Play podcast, hosted by Kyron Powell and Jordan Shannon. We hope you enjoyed this immersive dive into the world of cricket and business, exploring the unique experiences and perspectives of players past and present, alongside those invaluable insights into intriguing business themes that transcend beyond the boundaries of sporting heroics. Be sure to set your reminders on your Alexa or Google Home device. Or we won't tell anyone if you still use those paper calendar things from a bygone era. Join us next time for more inspiring dialogue with scintillating minds on the Power Play podcast.